Willie King with Terrorized. Terror happens everywhere. And we're doing a segment today on torture. And I'm here with George Cattermole. This edition of Shedding Lights. And right now, bringing on a author. And I'm not even going to try to pronounce his last name. Hector, can you please introduce yourself?
Okay, it's Hector Aristizabal.
Hector Aristizabal, and I also had a hard time with that name, and when I was reading your book, I found out that your father told you it was perhaps Basque.
Yes, apparently our ancestors came from the Basque country.
Well, I want to tell people that I'm speaking here with Hector Aristizabal. He's a psychologist, he's an artist, he's an activist, and I just finished his book a few days ago, The Blessings Next to the Wound, and it's an incredibly powerful book. You were tortured.
Yes, in Colombia in 1982.
And I read about your brothers, both of whom I'm sorry to say, I'm sorry that they're not with us any longer, but also victims of a society that, that tortures. And with the Americans' help, is that true? Or
well, yes. I mean, my youngest brother died of AIDS, and yes, we could say that one of the reasons why we could say it was torture because there was very little access to the appropriate medications at that time. Mm-hmm. And like most countries are 5-10 years behind the advances in medication everywhere else, especially in the United States. And my second youngest brother, Juan Fernando, was kidnapped, tortured, and killed by the paramilitary death squads in Colombia, mm-hmm. Which are the right-wing arm of the military and the government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was your story of your growing up there in Medellin, the town, the city. When you talked early on, you were involved in several different and couple different personalities. Is it Zizito? Exito? Is that how you pronounce it? When you when you went out into the streets, and I was just amazed at your using acting and roles and disguises, I guess, in a sense, to penetrate scenes and to learn and then react by trying to help people. That's what was so powerful about your book, I think, is when you did escape and come here, the kind of work you've been doing with kids in L.A. who are on the wrong side of the law, and what you told me about my own system and my own country here, our country now, I guess yours too, was just shocking. How we are so violent to innocent people, and some people who may not be innocent, but how did they get to where they got? The way you dealt with that, I was really impressed. You were at the conference, the Quit conference, in Ben Lomond last weekend. I wonder if you could tell us what happened there.
This is several things that you just mentioned. Let's start by the last one. The Quit conference is an amazing effort by the Quakers to end torture, and this is the third time they come together. I have been fortunate enough to have been invited and participated in the three conferences. And they just come to reflect and to inform themselves about what's happening in terms of the participation of this government in torture everywhere, not just during the Bush administration, but unfortunately the Obama administration has not changed anything, even the promises that they made to close Guantanamo, etc. So it's an effort that I really applaud, and the Quakers have been people who have been involved in many of the things that I really care about, which you mentioned, like the prison system. We, the so-called land of the free, have 25% of the world's prisoners. And it's a paradox that it's just mind-boggling for everybody who realizes that a country that calls itself free has most of the youth in prison, especially the so-called youth of color, African Americans and Latinos. So that's a population that I had worked with as well. And in Los Angeles, for many years, I worked with the so-called gang members, or the kids in trouble. And my understanding is that the job of youth is to be in trouble, but the job of the adults is to try to help them figure out the right kind of trouble. And we are doing a very lousy job at doing that, but an excellent job at both pathologizing and criminalizing children and putting them in prison. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's a little bit of the... And as you said, most of my work has been informed by the events and the ordeals of my own personal life. Like when I lost my brother to AIDS, I worked for several years with Bienestar, which is the largest organization working with AIDS and HIV, and it was a way for me to try to understand what he went through and try to help others, because I could not help my brother, my own brother, very well. And then my involvement with torture survivors from all over the world is also a way to honor my own brother who was killed, tortured and killed, and many, many other people, not just him, but many other people that unfortunately had suffered torture. I was one of the few fortunate ones to survive in Colombia. So I feel a very strong need to keep them alive by telling their stories.
And I was so impressed by the techniques that you use, that you use theater, you use role playing, and so on, and the specific examples. I recommend to everybody out there that you get a hold of this book, The Blessing Next to the Wound, because I never thought about it, but you mentioned something called survivor guilt, and I hadn't quite thought about it until I read your description of how you found yourself immersed in that.
I mean, of course, like many people who have gone through difficult ordeals in life, I deal with the trauma of the torture itself. But what I noticed after many years is that one of the strongest feelings I had is the question, why my brother, why the many intellectuals, artists, and beautiful people who had been tortured and killed? And the question is, why not me? Why the bullets kept going and spare my body and then hit somebody else that I love or that I admire and not me? And so it's some kind of survivor's guilt. I found myself putting myself in the wolf's mouth and playing with my life many times, and discovered that on the one hand, it's as if we want them to kill us or to end the pain, so we don't feel anything else. But on the other hand, it's like a self-punishment. It's like, why am I still here? I'm supposed to be dead, because I had done the same things that many other people have done and paid the ultimate price for it. But then, like the book's title, The Blessing Next to the Wound, which is an old saying from Africa, and I have found very similar thoughts in other cultures, which is that the ordeals in our life are not there to screw us up or to make us victims, but our job is to find meaning in those ordeals. It's the word suffering used to mean to bear it, and because pain is going to happen to all of us. There is absolute guarantee that pain is going to come in many, many different ways. But the idea is that we learn from it, and then we find what is called the medicine in it, and we can share it with other people, how we were able to come out of those deep pits that sometimes life throws us into. And I just want to add also that the book was possible thanks to Diane Lefer, a very good friend of mine who did an interview several years ago, and we had such a good response to the interview that we continue working together, and she really helped me a lot to bring the story out. So she's a co-author of the book.
Oh, yes. And you have a couple things I was curious about. You have a play, Nightwind. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, Nightwind is... When the Abu Ghraib pictures came out, I was offended, like many people who have been tortured. Every time we see images of torture, somehow it takes you back to the chamber. But I was more offended by the reaction of the American people that saying, oh, no, those are just a few bad apples. That's not who we are. And I said, that's not true. So at the time, Michael Nutkevich, who was the director of the Program for Torture Victims, the oldest program in the country that is located in Los Angeles, suggested that I did an improvisation to show people that this is something that has been going on for many years. And I did that, telling my story and my brother's story. I noticed that the reaction of people was so strong that invited a few friends of mine, B.J. Dodge, who is a director, and Diane Lefer, who is a writer, and a friend of mine who is a musician, and Sofina. And we started improvisations and developed the play that is now called Nightwing, in which I tell my story and the story of my brother. And then I have taken it to more than 25 universities in this country and to more than 15 countries around the world. And I show my story in a theatrical way. It's not just confessional theater. It has the distancing effect, so people know they're watching a play, even though they know that it's based on my own personal life. And then I develop a whole workshop using techniques from Theater of the Oppressed, which was developed by Augusto Boal from Brazil, and other techniques to help to engage in a dialogue through images, what I call embodied knowledge. Through spontaneous reactions to the play, we all reflect on what is our direct and indirect participation in the fact that torture is something that our government has engaged in indirectly and lately directly in the world. So that's using art as a tool, as a mechanism to both seek social justice, but also, in the oldest meaning of theater, as a healing ritual.
And is that is the name of your company? Is it Imagine Action? Imagine Action, is that the troupe, the name of the troupe?
Or yes. That's a group of friends, artists, and many of them interested in social justice. And we have been doing several projects in prisons, and I'm actually the one who has been traveling the most, but I travel and train people in different places in the world in the use of the techniques. But what we call awakening the imagination, the lack of imagination or the collapse of imagination in the culture is one of the biggest problems that I notice, not only in government, but in education, in therapy. And I think that the possibility to imagine a different world than the world we have in the moment is a human right. It's a basic human right, that humans have that incredible capacity. So I use theater and drumming and dancing and ritual to reconnect groups with that inherent capacity that we all have.
Yes, and I was very much impressed the way you're working with youth in L.A., using some of those techniques, and they seem to work. But I had no idea how basically, I guess, rotten our system is, and unimaginative, really stupid the way it's treating 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds, who may have done something wrong, but the reaction to that was just horrified me. And you said something that really, really struck me that I've thought a lot about. I've never quite been able to put it the way you put it, but you talked about not getting rid of anger, but get rid of violence, but don't get rid of anger. And I've thought a lot about that. I mean, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. But what to do with that rage? You know, that's how to direct it. And what I took from part of your book, for example, you mentioned the activities of Occidental Petroleum, Drummond Limited, Chiquita Brands. I don't know if I'm going to eat another banana, but I think, I guess, you know, things that people can do to stop this madness. Do you have anything just suggestions for our audience?
What I usually do with groups is to engage in these techniques where we are able to engage in a dialogue that is not just ideological or rational, but a dialogue that engages our bodies and our energies and our desire to connect to each other. And from that, different ideas appear. I try not to tell people what to do because I don't believe in that, but to invite people to somehow polarize each other, like sometimes I don't know what to do, especially with these humongous problems like torture. But I can see someone else create an image that I said, oh, I can do that. And it goes from praying to healing to visiting people in prison to writing letters to the editor to doing what you're doing right now, spreading the words and to becoming a witness that becomes engaged. But it's I think that we all have to become aware that the system we are living under is unsustainable, and there are so many ways to prove that. And that it takes each one of us to become aware of what in our lives we can change. What is it that we can do? Because we all can do something. We all have are participating in this, benefiting from all the privileges that we have access to. And therefore, we can also transform things. So there are many ways. I don't tell people what to do, but I invite people to look at what they... what moves them, you know, what inspires them. Maybe torture is not the topic that they should get engaged with, but everywhere you look, there is something that has to change. Education, the environment, government, the prison system, etc., etc. And I just tell people, what is it that vibrates with you, that triggers your soul, and work on that, and imagine things with that.
Mm-hmm. And we played some music here the first part of this show, and I'm really very, very blessed to have a lot of musicians that play at my place. I think of Insurgent Art. That's a name of a book that Lawrence Ferlinghetti, the poet, wrote. It doesn't not necessarily art that is directly, you know, aimed at ending torture or what have you, but that art is a way to address these problems. And I in your I guess really autobiography, you talk about you just mentioned the death of a poet you knew, Chucho, is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, Chucho Peña. Yes.
Chucho Peña. And I wondered if you don't say too much about it except that he was a poet, and I just wondered you could tell me a little bit more about him and the effect that had on you, the death of not just a person, but a person who was a poet.
Yeah, he was a friend of mine when I was young, and a neighbor also. And he wrote poetry. He was cross-eyed, and that, among many other things, was a motive of him being bullied and being rejected and being made fun of for many years. But he found in poetry a way to find his voice, and a very strong voice. Unfortunately, because of that, he was taken by the military at the time and was tortured and killed. Well, I, after I was tortured, a few weeks later, his brother told me if I could come with him, because they had called him that they had found his body. And I don't know why, I decided to come with him. And we found him on a ditch. And one of his eye has been gouged out. His fingernails were taken away. He has burns everywhere, etc. I mean, it was horrifying. And he was starting to decompose as well. And what happened is that somehow that horrendous scene reminded me of what could have happened to me. And I still don't know what the circumstances were that they didn't do that to me, because they were doing that to many people at the time. And it looks like it was because I was tortured during the week of presidential elections in Colombia, and there were international delegates visiting the country that has been accused of human rights violations. So the president, Turbay Ayala, at the time, wanted to show that, no, we don't do any of that. So I think the presence of these international people, that I will never know whose names, who they were, saved my life and my brother's life and the other people that were in the chambers at the time, the torture chambers. But going back to Chucho Peña, somehow that image is the image that I had to endure many years later in 1999, when as I arrived to the country, when I was told that my brother had been kidnapped, I went to the funeral home and received his body. That was on a plastic black bag, and I ordered an autopsy and noticed that a lot of the same things had been done to him. He had burns all over his body. He He had broken ribs. His intestines were empty. He had not eaten in many, many days. They took him for 10 days, and the last day they shot him on the head and blew his brains. And I took pictures of that. I don't know why. At the time, I was just screaming and vomiting and saying, this cannot be in vain. This cannot be... I mean, I didn't want this to just go unnoticed as this happened to at least 20 people, statistically, 20 people every day in my country, in Colombia alone. And the problem is that no one wants to see it, especially the families, because it's horrendous to look at your son or your brother or your friend in those conditions, in such dehumanizing conditions. So I took pictures, and later on I was able to look at them, and later on a documentary called Hidden in Plain Sight about the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. A documentarian asked me if he could use some of those pictures, and so somehow the story is being told. I also, when I visited Dianne Feinstein at her office many years ago, I told her, listen, this is what you are supporting in Colombia. And I showed her the pictures, and she said to me, how do you know this is in Colombia? How do you know this is real? And I said, because that's my brother. And I took those pictures. She was very uncomfortable after that. So I tried to use that as a way to show people how dehumanized we have become. And this has to change, you know, that these are real people who are being killed. These are not monsters. The kids that we throw in prison are not even criminals, are not even violent criminals. Most of them are in prison for drug charges, and they go to prison for 15, 20, 30 years. When I talk about this in other countries, they cannot believe. They said, you're lying. And I showed them some documentaries about the prison system here. And one time, a man in Japan got up after the documentary. He was crying, and he said, listen, I killed someone, and I'm going to tell you why. And I went to prison, and I should have gone to prison. I was there for 6 years, but now I am here, and I work, and I am a citizen. In the United States, once a prisoner, once a criminal, always a criminal, you know? Mm-hmm. Our recidivism, for example, is 75%. When people get out of prison, they end up, 75% of them end up back in prison. Because they're criminals? No, because we have institutionalized them and convinced them that they are just criminals. And most of these people have never committed a violent crime.
Yes, and I want to thank you of your bearing witness to this. Again, I want to ask people out there to please go and get a copy of this book, The Blessing Next to the Wound, because the experience is not just describing what's wrong, but you have very creative ways of dealing with these kids. I was really impressed, making a difference. I really want to thank you for talking to us today, and maybe we're going to try to get you to come to Stanford and do some of your work here.
It will be an honor, my friend. And I'm sorry that you mentioned art, and I think art, like other practices, are the best way to reach the heart. I've seen art change life. It saved my life. It changed my life. And when I work with kids, it's always an incredible way to work with them and to see who they are, who they really are.
Okay. Well, thanks again very, very much for being with us.
Okay, George. Thank you so much.
I hope to meet you someday.
Take care.
Goodbye.
All right. Yeah. Bye-bye.
I'd like to just read very quickly a description that Hector gives of what how he really views himself and what he's done. He says he doesn't want to presume the title of shaman, but like a shaman or a teacher. He says he's descended to hell, but has also returned, and that means he knows the path. He can go and come back, descend and return, and from those terrible depths, the shaman brings back medicine and knowledge. Since my arrest and torture, I've carried the knowledge of how fragile we are, how tenuous our safety. I know I can fall apart again, and I have done so. But I've also had the experience of rebuilding myself, and that, too, I know I can do. He's helped a lot of people, and you can find out about that again in his book, The Blessing Next to the Wound.
George Cattermole, I want to thank you for this next edition of Shedding Light today. You always bring some heavy stuff when you come. How has this affected you? You went and saw Hector, our author, just now. You saw him at this Quaker event last weekend?
No, I did not see him, but I did get a hold of his book and read his book.
And how did it change you?
I was touched. Well, again, I mentioned that. It made me very angry. And I, as I say, I came across that statement of his, which is when he's working with these kids in L.A. who are quite angry about a lot of things. They come from broken homes, horrible situations that they're having to deal with and cope with. You want to be angry at situations like this about how these kids are treated and so on, but you don't want to have that issue in violence. But you've got to somehow direct that anger and find some way of dealing with it. And that's what this man has done in a big way, all over the place: Israel, Palestine, Iraq. I mean, he's taken his art and his therapies and so on all over the place to try to end terror. Torture, violence, what have you, mm-hmm. And insurgent art, I guess, is the theme that's sort of taken over my life the last couple of years. Ferlinghetti's work. We were at the City Lights bookstore last week, and mm-hmm. What was going on there? We were listening to stories that aren't really told in our media or really dealt with as fully as they should be. But to keep criticizing. We're Americans. Our tax dollars are supporting a lot of very ugly things in the world, and we as taxpayers, as citizens, have to actively oppose this.
If folks want to get a hold of you, George, how can they?
Well, they can get a hold of me at the San Gregorio General Store. I have a phone number there, 650-726-0565. Check my messages. You can reach me that way.
Since you give out your phone number, you got an email, too?
Email is my name, George Cattermole at earthlink.net, GEORGECATTERMOLE at earthlink.net.
Okay, thanks for your time, George. Stand by for more exciting radio here on KZSU Stanford.